This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. One of the state's leading economists predicts strong growth for New Hampshire next year, but even as employers look to expand, new hires struggle to find housing. Drive until you can afford it is a strategy many workers have already adopted, commuting 30, 40, 50 miles or more because renting or owning closer to the job is just too expensive. That's why at a housing forum earlier this fall, the Business and Industry Association said that Granite State's lack of affordable housing is a top concern. But where to plan these projects and what kind has always been a sticking point. New Hampshire's rural character, its small town feel, and its varied local zoning laws have long been a part of this conversation. Today in The Exchange, how to break ground on affordable housing. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests for the hour with us in studio, Dean Kristen, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority. And Dean, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Dennis DeLay, economist at the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies and co-author of a new three-part report commissioned by the Housing Finance Authority. And Dennis, welcome back to you, too.
Great to be here, Laura. Thank you.
Well, you were that economist I quoted, Dennis, at an economic forum just last week. You predicted 2016 would be a good year for New Hampshire, and it was good to hear you say that, for the economy, for employment. But in housing, you said, Dennis, and I'm quoting you, there has to be a serious look at our housing policies and their impact on economic development. What do you mean there?
Well, I think, again, as you outlined in the BIA conference, that I think employers are becoming more and more concerned about the availability of housing and the affordability of housing, because that has real implications for workforce development. I mean, the unemployment rate in New Hampshire is already down to 3.6%. It's one of the lowest in the country, I think fourth lowest in the country. So that means that labor markets are very tight. So I think employers are interested in trying to attract new people to the area, keep the people that we have in the area, just so that they can meet their workforce needs. So there is a link, I think, between housing, affordable housing, and economic development.
So what does our housing policy look like in New Hampshire as a state? Because so much is determined town by town. So can you even say, Dennis, that there is an our housing policy, you know, statewide housing policy?
Well, I think there are attempts to there have been attempts by the legislature to prescribe an affordable housing policy. There was a workforce housing legislation that was passed a couple of years ago, which essentially says that individual towns have to provide their own fair share of affordable housing in each of their towns. Now, some towns are taking that to heart, and other towns, I think, are a little concerned, as you say, about maybe too much development. It's interesting. I was telling Dean a few minutes ago that I off air that I was at a planning group or a planning board for a town that will remain nameless that's north of here in Concord. And, you know, we were talking about this issue. I was talking about the economic forecast, and that that town has some property that's very close to Interstate 93, and they're still talking about, well, what kind of a development do we encourage, you know, just off the exit to the highway? Discussions centered around, well, manufacturing or a retail establishment. And when the subject of multifamily housing came up, people around the table start to say, oh, well, we're not sure we want that because, you know, that means more kids in the schools and more, you know, potentially more cost to the town. But by the same token, I think people are starting to realize that if you don't have housing that's affordable for families, then you're also not going to have a workforce.
Well, that's the thing. And I, for years, you know, Dennis, we've talked about that concern that if you build multifamily housing, you'll bring in a bunch of kids and then you have to expand your schools and that's expensive. But it seems like we've almost moved on, right, to another concern, which is not enough kids,
well,
not enough young people.
That's exactly right. I mean, in virtually every city and town in New Hampshire, the school-age population has been declining. And statewide, I think we've lost maybe 30,000 to 40,000 school-age kids. And that doesn't mean that we've lost them per se. What's happened is, you know, we have fewer people moving into the state. People in New Hampshire don't have as many children as some other groups do in some other states nationally. So that just means fewer kids in the schools.
So, Dean, I'd love your thoughts, too, about this idea of New Hampshire's housing policy. I mean, does New Hampshire even have a housing policy or is it all local?
It is mostly local. The legislature did in 2008, as Dennis pointed out, adopt what I think people refer to as the workforce housing law. And what that really says is that communities have to be sure that their zoning does not interfere with the ability of the private sector to build housing that will meet the needs of a workforce. It doesn't say that they have to build the housing, doesn't say that they have, in fact, to have a certain percentage of their housing stock that meets certain standards, simply that they can't artificially inhibit the ability of the private sector to respond to this need that he's talking about by building housing that meets the needs of either people at certain income levels. And a number of communities have responded to that, and you see some change in the character, if you will, of the kind of housing that perhaps is being built in certain places as a result of the change in that law. Whether it is widespread enough, whether we've seen enough scale yet, is I think the issue that we're talking about here. We went through a long period of recession, and the housing market really didn't need a lot more inventory at that point. Now that it's back, now that there is some growth, we're going to start seeing this tension come back again between developers who want to build to respond to that need and communities that have these concerns that Dennis is talking about.
So it's sort of a new old problem, Dean.
It is deja vu all over again. And we've gone through this before. The difference now, I think, is twofold. One is we do have this statute, which is a real thing that people need to be thoughtful about. And secondly, I do think there's been a lot of time and energy put into educating people about this nexus between the economic health of the state and a balanced and adequate supply of housing. The question is, people may be supportive of housing, but it's housing in general is always a good thing. Housing in specific may not be a very good thing from people's perspective.
Lots more to talk about, but I also want to invite our listeners to join us. The exchange number for you to be part of our conversation on affordable housing and rising concerns that there's not enough in New Hampshire, that it could drag our economy down as workers struggle to find housing they can afford. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And both of you, let's go to the phones. Kathleen's joining us from Peterborough. Hi, Kathleen. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call. A couple of points. We have the housing when it's built, but a lot of people come in and they're getting the free checks. They're not the workers. And that puts an infringement on it. And the housing that is built is not really affordable for workers, whether it's apartment rentals or housing. It's just too expensive for the ordinary worker who's not making big money.
So free checks. What are you talking about, Kathleen?
Well, welfare checks and those kinds of things that people are not out there actually working. So it's not really working housing that gets created.
I see what you're saying. So, guys, this is important because there's a lot of definitions because there's what's called, you know, subsidized housing, public housing, Section 8, whatever you want to call it, Dean. Mm-hmm. Then there's affordable housing. Then there's workforce housing. Lots of terms.
Well, you know, there's very limited resources available to actually build housing that is subsidized directly for individuals. And a little bit of that does get created every year, and it tends to target very low-income people, tends to target people with disabilities, seniors perhaps. The housing I think we're talking about here in the broader sense is market rate housing that is designed to meet the needs of a growing workforce and is not likely to have a direct public subsidy. Frankly, if that's the only way we're going to address this housing issue, we're never going to solve it because there's never going to be enough resources to do that. I do think one of the things that the caller points out, though, that is accurate is that given the cost of creating housing, sometimes the housing that does get created, particularly the new housing that gets created, tends to target the higher end of the market.
Because you get more return.
Exactly. And because the cost of creating it is so high. And among the things that lead to that cost is how much can you build, where can you build it, how quickly can you build it. So if you have communities that say, yes, we'll allow you to build rental housing or we allow you to build multifamily housing of a different type, but we're going to limit how many units you can build in a particular year, or we're going to limit where you can do it, or we're going to place other kinds of requirements on that that may seem logical to them at the time, but what it does is it adds cost. The developer's only choice is to add that cost into the other end of the housing, and that means the cost of selling it or the cost of renting it goes up.
Well, this is a question I wanted to ask you too, Dean, as an economist. So several recent affordable housing projects that I read about in preparing for the show today, West Lebanon, Woodstock, Vermont, you know, it's amazing. They fill up within days, and you know, they barely open the doors, and every unit is filled, and there's often a waiting list for people who didn't get in. So Economics 101, Dennis, supply is supposed to meet demand. Why aren't builders jumping over each other to create these, given that there seems to be so many people who want these units?
Well, I think for the very reasons that Dean was talking about, that there are local ordinances and not only on-the-book type ordinances, but also just a general reluctance sometimes, I think, from planning and zoning boards to allow this type of housing in, or more, maybe even more importantly, to grant a variance to the existing regulations so something new can be built. I should say, too, just to add to Dean's point, that a number of these projects are combined projects. In other words, there's low-income housing, but there's also a market rate component that's part of it. So so again, I think it's difficult sometimes for planning boards to sort of get their arms around something new, a new concept.
All right. Well, speaking of planning boards, perfect segue, Dennis. Thank you very much, because we have with us now on the phone Art Rugg. He's chair of Londonderry's Planning Board, a community that has been debating where and how to build affordable housing. Art Rugg, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Welcome.
So what does the housing stock in Londonderry look like today, Art, and what's missing?
The bulk of the housing in Londonderry is a traditional one-acre single-family dwelling. And Londonderry has been basically a bedroom community to both Manchester and the state of Massachusetts, which is the greater Boston area. And once the state had passed the Workforce Housing Ordinance, which is RSA 674:58-61,
that's the 2008 law that a couple people have referenced. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. We had been working on, we knew it was coming, and been working on a workforce housing ordinance, so what we call the inclusionary housing. And what we had allowed was in any residential area, 20 acres or greater, you can build multifamily housing. And that took several attempts to get passed through the town council. It was finally adopted in January of 2010. It was fairly quiet up to about 2014, and we had a 78-unit project come in, which is from the Neighborhood Works, Southern New Hampshire. And that was granted, site plan, and once they had things built, it filled right up. It's a beautiful project and everything, it just filled right up. We have another one that has just recently has site plan approval, but it had to go through the Zoning Board of Adjustment because our a workforce housing ordinance called for 16 units per building and at least 75% workforce housing, which is part of the definition in the state statute.
Right.
They said, the developer said they couldn't build it at with those two requirements. So the ZBA finally granted 24 units per unit and also, per building. And then 50% had to be workforce housing. And part of the requirement is the workforce housing, and regular market housing is all looks alike, so you can't tell it.
So did that go through okay? Was that, approved?
That went through because it was near Exit 5 and I-93 in Londonderry, so it had good, easy highway access. It had public water. It had public sewer. And the developer was extremely good, worked very closely with the neighborhood and everything.
So, Art, what would you say the general feeling about affordable housing, about workforce housing, call it what you will, is in Londonderry, given, you know, you're mostly a suburban community, but people do need this housing and they like the easy access that you have to the highway? What's the general feeling in your town?
Well, the third one engendered quite a bit of heat from the community because the feeling was, you know, most people that come from the city, they wanted the rural atmosphere. And Londonderry is a town of 25,000 people, so it does really hide its population well, but they didn't feel it was Londonderry.
So people felt like it was losing that sort of rural character that attracted them in the first place.
Exactly. So the ZBA did grant them, you know, approval. It's in design review right now. It is in proximity to public sewer, public water. Highway is probably another problem that hasn't been dealt with yet. The planning board hasn't seen it. But I think there could be some problems with it, but the overriding concern is that, you know, we're kind of like a bedroom community, but we're growing. We're growing both commercially and industrially, and there's a lot of traffic, hustle and bustle.
Sure.
And, you know, the economic good times at least have hit Londonderry in terms of commercial and industrial development.
So how does Londonderry maintain that lovely character and accommodate the workforce housing? And is there a point where you say we can't accommodate it anymore?
Well, what we've done is, one, we're going through a zoning ordinance because our zoning laws were passed in 1963 and have had 429 amendments. So we think it's high time to start taking a look at it.
How many amendments, Art?
429.
Wow.
So from the zoning.
It's a lot of amendments.
Yes. Yeah, so from the audit, we first look at workforce housing and how we can update our 2010 ordinance. And we found the big objection was these multifamily housing in, basically residential areas. We call our residential areas agricultural residential one. And there was opposition to that. So we took a look and said, well, how about if we had, like, much smaller units, you know, something that could replicate like a single-family house, but maybe allow, you know, two families in there.
Yeah, the cluster development or village concept. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then we thought, well, we could have, like, you could have, like, a farmhouse type in there. You'd have a barn. You could have two units in the house and two units in the barn.
So it gives you that rural character, but it isn't quite. It's housing maybe a couple families.
Yes,
Art, I do have to let you go, but we're going to talk about this in a moment. So thank you very much for the ideas, and good luck whittling down those amendments. Thank you very much, Art. So, Dean Kristen, Dennis DeLay, we heard some interesting ideas there from Art about, okay, we want to keep the rural character. We want to make it look beautiful. People move here because they don't want to live in, you know, a city like Manchester. And Dean, he was throwing out some interesting
adaptations. Londonderry's been working very hard at this, and I think you hear that in what Art was talking about. There are a number of potentially creative ways that communities can try to retain what they see as being the historic character of their community, but at the same time provide more flexibility for housing. One of the things he mentioned is this notion of allowing houses, buildings that look perhaps like a large single-family home but might have two or four apartment units in them. And this is not a new idea. This has been done. It was actually pioneered years ago in suburbs of Washington, in Maryland, where there was a similar dynamic where there was a need for more rental housing or more condominium-style housing. Communities that had perceived of themselves as rural said, we don't really want to see a lot of traditional multifamily housing, and they went in that direction, and it worked for them. The one caveat that you have to keep in mind is there is a cost dynamic to that. It is going to be more expensive to build that rental housing that way than it would be to put 24 units in a very traditional apartment building. And
build something new from the ground.
Exactly. And there is this trade-off. And I think the thing that we encourage communities to be open to is to understanding that there is this economic trade-off between the aesthetics, if you will, that people want, and it's not unreasonable that they want those things. But at the same time, if you want to get housing that's affordable, and this goes back to Kathleen's point, which is a lot of what gets built now is too expensive to actually meet the need that is emerging. And so we need to be thoughtful about what kind of requirements we place on a builder that then leads to those costs at the other
end. I see. So if we make it look too, you know, quaint and New Hampshire-y and rural and it's lovely and it looks like an old barn, that's great, but that adds to the cost and then it's not affordable anymore.
Correct.
Right. Dean? Yeah,
well,
Dennis?
No, again, I was just – we talked a few minutes ago about supply and demand. New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority does an excellent survey every year that looks at rental prices for multi-bedroom and two-bedroom apartments and also vacancy rates. And what that survey has showed in the last – probably the last 4 or 5 years is increasing rents, even as housing prices at some points have fallen after the recession, but rents never did. So that is an indication that there's increased demand for rental property. And right now I think the statewide vacancy rate for rental properties in New Hampshire is close to 3% or maybe even under 3%. In most most housing experts will tell you that a 5% vacancy rate for rental housing is probably a comfortable margin to have. So when you get much below that, it really tells you you have a very tight market, you've got too much demand and too little supply.
Did you want to jump back in there?
Yeah,
Dave?
I was just going to say that actually the vacancy rate, as Dennis points out, is probably statewide is under 3%, but there are market areas where it's actually under 2% and even around 1%, which basically means there is no vacancy, and that will continue to push prices up. So we went through a housing recession that was devastating on the single family side. It had virtually no impact on the rental side of our markets. And so we've had this rental housing shortage for a long time. It's now being accentuated by the fact that we're starting to see some economic growth. We're starting to see some in-migration. We're starting to see people leaving their families' homes. And so household formation is up, and which is all a good thing.
Right.
Except it puts pressure on this market and could lead to some more negative things if we don't react to it.
Well, and here's a Facebook comment to the point that you said that vacancy rates vary around this state. Maura says to our Facebook question, have you struggled to find affordable housing in your town? Maura says, not up north. Apartments and houses are inexpensive comparatively. And she says, I moved up here after being priced out of my town because of college kids and landlords jacking up rent. So, Dean, partly it's location, location, location.
Right, right. The market dynamics are very, very different. It is absolutely true that in the North Country there are still high inventory of single-family homes. Prices have not grown. Rental housing is not as expensive, although interestingly enough, there are pockets in what we might think of as rural parts of the state that have very, very strong markets. So, for instance, we were talking earlier about Grafton County, and if you go to the Hanover-Lebanon area, a very strong market, a lot of economic activity, a lot of strength in that market, and a lot of demand for housing. There's been some movement to try to react to that. But right now, that is a very tight housing market.
And very low vacancy rates there as well, right?
That's right.
Yeah, and we're going to talk to somebody in a few minutes, actually, from that area, an employer who's struggling to help employees find housing. Here's another Facebook comment to our question, what do you see as the biggest barrier to making housing more affordable? Len says, political will. NIMBY is still quite rampant. The dominant narrative is that bringing people with less income will reduce rather than enrich communities. And Len says that's not proven. There's a stigma there, Dennis.
Yeah, I think there is. But I think that, as again, I agree with some of the things that Dean said. I think there is a movement afoot to sort of change the dynamic for towns to try to think more creatively. I think one of the things that's happening is for some towns that have older populations, they're really wondering whether they can have enough people to man their volunteer fire department.
All right. More after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the rising cost and decreasing availability of affordable housing in New Hampshire. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests in studio are Dean Kristen, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority, and Dennis DeLay, economist at the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies and co-author of a new three-part report commissioned by the Housing Finance Authority. And joining us now from the Upper Valley, a region that has really struggled with this housing issue, is Carolyn Maloney. She's treasurer for Hypertherm, Inc., a manufacturer and major employer in the Upper Valley. And Carolyn, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
How is this housing issue affecting your ability to recruit new talent?
So being a manufacturer in the state of New Hampshire, we hire roughly 1,400 associates worldwide, with 1,200 of those in the United States. And so our predominant manufacturing plant is here in Hanover, New Hampshire, and it's a constant struggle to hire, you know, not just talent in the manufacturing area, but also engineers, finance associates, IT, et cetera, because they note when they get here that the average cost of a home is in excess of $250,000. A median income for a family of four is about $60,000. So in the affordability index is not, it's out of balance. And so people are driving, you know, 30 to 40 miles one way to get to work, which has a negative impact on family, time with family, as well as health, you know, long-term health issues, as well as the environment.
Wow. So you're hearing from employees about health issues, family issues, just because they can't live close to work.
Yes, because it's more expensive for the child care because they're having to have an extra hour on both ends of the day for the child care pieces. Also, when it gets to bad weather, with snowstorms, icy roads, et cetera, they're having to drive, you know, 30, 40 miles to get to work. And so absenteeism increases. And then, you know, just the overall driving commute and just the stress of everything does create sickness issues as well.
Wow. So an effect on employee productivity and so forth. Are you folks at Hypertherm in conversations with Hanover and the close-in towns about, hey, why don't you build us, build some more housing? We could use it.
Yeah, so we have been, we've worked with different affordable housing organizations and advocacy groups. We aren't one to, you know, through our HOPE Foundation, we contribute to those organizations. So inherently through those contributions, we do support that and are continuously talking about the need. But also a key item here is also transportation, because we are a three-shift company, and we don't run a two-tier work environment, which means that we don't, you know, have one type of benefit for the people in the office versus a different type of benefit for the manufacturing. We really try to have consistency throughout. We have created, through a creative means, transportation options for all shifts, through van pools, carpool, economic benefits for our associates, et cetera. So not only the housing, but if the housing can't be built, what other transportation options are there for our people to make things easier for them?
What role do you see the business community in the Upper Valley playing in this push for more affordable housing, especially given some of the concerns we heard about earlier? You know, it's beautiful in the Upper Valley. People don't want to feel like they're living in a city.
Mm-hmm. So Hypertherm's view is that we have to be in the forefront. We have to be working with the organizations that are building the affordable housing for the associates and for the community. We have to be on the forefront of understanding what those needs are and being there to help counter those. And we can't be the quiet, you know, person on the sidelines not doing anything, because the issues will only get worse. And honestly, it creates stress amongst the associate base, and they get fed up and they leave, or you can't attract them. So companies have to be on the forefront, working with the groups that can work in these and actually putting money and voice behind it, pushing for change.
Wow. So you really are hearing employees saying, forget it. It's, you know, love working for you, but it's just too stressful.
Oh, well, yes. Or I can't afford I can't afford the housing that's near where I need to work, and I need to have the balance between work and family, and I can't be driving an hour, 2 hours a day away from my family.
So here's another question for you as a business, Carolyn. Is there a wage issue here? I mean, could businesses in New Hampshire just pay people more so they can afford the housing? Maybe it's not a housing cost problem. Maybe it's a wage problem.
So that is, you know, there's a list of about six things that Hypotherm has done to focus on this. And I talked about the commuting benefits as well as public transportation. We've talked about the piece around van pooling as well as flexible work schedules. But the last thing is really the development of people. And so we have worked with the state and created education. We have an HTTI program, which is where we're hiring people that maybe don't have manufacturing experience, but train them for manufacturing. And as people develop, their wage does go up. So we're very focused on the development of people. We put about 3% annually of our sales level for development of our people. And as people develop, it correlates to wage increases.
So they'll make bigger salaries and maybe could afford to move closer in.
Exactly. So it's not just increasing salaries for the point of increasing salaries. It's really developing the people that will cause the increase of salaries.
Well, Carolyn, real interesting. Thank you very much for being with us.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for having me.
Carolyn Maloney, treasurer for Hypotherm, Inc., a manufacturer and major employer in the Upper Valley that has been very focused on this housing issue because of the impacts that we heard about on its employees. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And gentlemen, before we go back to our listeners, Dennis, I did want to ask you about the wage issue as well, because you've talked a lot about stagnating wages mm-hmm. and so forth. Is the problem affordable housing, or is it that people don't make enough money?
Well, I think we've been through a very long period right now where not only manufacturers like Hypotherm, but also service industries and retail trade industries have been able to hire people without bidding up wages by that much. That is starting to turn around. We heard Carolyn talk about it pretty clearly. Nationally, what we're seeing is that the rate at which people quit their jobs is rising significantly faster than the rate at which people get laid off from their jobs or otherwise separated from their jobs. So that's always a signal to us in the economics profession that wages are going to get bid up pretty quickly.
Wow, so the quit rate is up.
Well, the quit rate is up, and what that really means is people are leaving their jobs not because they've been told to or because the company goes out of business, but they're doing it of their own volition. And what really happens in labor markets is employers – it really isn't a dance between the employer and the employee. It's a dance between employers. In other words, as people quit their jobs and because they have the promise of something better, that means another employer is willing to offer them more money. And I think that's – so we're starting to see that kind of competition among employers starting to bid wages up. Now, that might in some ways help the affordable housing situation, because if people make more money, then they'll be able to afford more house or maybe afford a slightly higher rent. But it's been a long time for us to get to this stage. The expectation is that we are going to see more wage demand or wage pull, and that might, in some ways, that might help the situation.
Well, interesting. So you talk about competition among employers. Dean, for you, what about competition among communities here in New Hampshire? Could some communities say, hey, we're a vibrant place. Look at this mix of housing options that we have, you know, cool people come here, young people come here, you know, we're the place to be.
Well, sure. There has been a lot of conversation, I think, about this issue of making a community attractive, particularly to younger people and to the growing workforce. And housing needs to be part of that conversation, and perhaps housing of a different type than we have historically thought about in New Hampshire. And one of the things Art mentioned is that Londonderry was a very typical sort of southern New Hampshire community, lots of large single-family homes on large lots. That was a something that people wanted, and it worked for a
in
long
the
80s. Time. There is a growing sense that younger people now perhaps want something different, at least for a while. They want housing that has more flexibility, which may mean rental housing. So if they want to move somewhere else and take another job, they're not tied down, if you will, by a house. They may want their first home that they own to be something that is smaller, has less maintenance responsibilities related to it, because that's just not what they're engaged in. They have other interests. So again, that affects what do we allow people to build, how much, and where in a very different way than what we traditionally do.
You know, demographics have really changed. I know I've talked about this before, but I'm a baby boomer. I just turned 65 this year. When I was of an age, you know, if you didn't have a good job in your late 20s and a steady relationship or even be married, and if you didn't have a house in your early 30s, you were some kind of a failure, the economic failure. The current generation that's in that age, the so-called millennials, don't think that way at all. They form permanent relationships much later in life, so they probably are more interested in rental housing as opposed to single-family housing, and they have fewer children than my generation did, so that means they're looking for something smaller.
All right, let's take another call, gentlemen. This is Gordon in Center Barnstead. Hi, Gordon. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
The panel are ignoring the major fact of the structure of small towns. I'm from a small town. If you have large numbers of small or economic housing, the economy of the town and the budget of the town is shot to hell. Excuse me. One child in school flattens the economic benefits of small housing, and they have to address this, the tax structure.
This has been the concern for a long time, Gordon. Yeah, so I hear you. That's always been the concern about building multifamily housing. We talked about this a little bit earlier, but go ahead, Dean Kristen. That's the worry. You build a big apartment, all these families come in, schools
right.
cost money. That's
right.
the argument for
a
long time.
You know, there is a lot of data that we have developed with a number of folks, including some of Dennis's colleagues, that show that the number of school children that are actually associated with rental housing in particular is much smaller than people think. And in fact, the reality is the place you get lots of kids is with large single-family homes that have 3-4 bedrooms. The rental housing that we see developed has very small numbers of school children.
So is that a myth?
It is indeed a myth, frankly. Now the reality is that you can't say that there will be no school children if you have a rental housing property. And the caller's point is well taken. That has to be taken into consideration by a community. I doubt that one child is going to make a fundamental difference in a community's budget. But the reality is that they do need to balance that. And that's why when we say we want a balanced supply of housing, we want communities to think about a little bit of rental housing and a little bit of other kind of housing at the same time.
Gordon, thanks for the call. Okay, Dennis DeLay. So in response again to Gordon's concern, and it's a common one, Dean talked about it a little bit, but I want your take on this as someone who studies economics and demographics here in New Hampshire.
Well, I would have loved to have asked Gordon how many school children he had in his town 2 decades ago and how many there are today, because the simple fact of the matter is in virtually every town in New Hampshire, we've seen declining school enrollment. About the only towns where there's been an exception to that are actually Manchester has seen a lot of in-migration and foreign in-migration into Manchester as well. But especially for the rural towns in New Hampshire, the school-age population has been on the whole declining. I think we are in a new economic and demographic reality. The simple fact of the matter is that the people that are reaching their childbearing years right now and their family forming years are having fewer children generally than the generations that preceded them. And that was, as I said, I'm a baby boomer. I'm the oldest of 7 children.
Wow.
You very rarely see anybody with a family that size in the current day. So, and you know, I was not. My family, I don't think, was an exception to the rule. I mean, there were a lot of large families back again in the 50s and the 60s. It's much more common today for individuals to have one, maybe two children, and so that means smaller school age populations. That means less pressure on property taxes.
So, and Gordon isn't with us anymore, and that's fine. I don't want to pick on him because this is a common concern. Again, mm-hmm. more kids, more schools, more roads, more taxes, and so on. So what would you say fundamentally, Dennis, to someone who has those concerns like Gordon? It's a new era. Your biggest worry shouldn't be more kids. It should be not enough kids. I mean, is that the bottom line
here? Well, I think maybe not on, you know, whether you have too many or too few kids, but I think whether you're attracting people to your community that are of workforce age, people in their late 20s to maybe early 40s, their late 40s, the people that are going to man the local volunteer fire department, the people that are going to provide services, whether they're at the community level or even the state level, the people that are going to work for the local ambulance and are going to work for the local police force. There was I thought this was a great metaphor that I don't think we did it here in New Hampshire, but there was another state in the country when talking about the workforce housing issue. The turn of phrase they came up with was housing for heroes. In other words, you want to be able to provide affordable housing options for the people in your community that are going to provide the services to
police,
you.
Police, fire, EMT.
Police, fire, the first responders. And, you know, it's a message that probably resonated more maybe a decade ago because of some of the things that were going on in the country at the time. But I thought it was a great way to sort of express and encapsulate the real need for workforce housing.
Dean, go ahead.
That's true. And I think that's a very good point. But it's also true, as we heard from Carolyn, that you know, companies are looking to hire entry level people as technicians, as manufacturing associates, and those people help make the economy turn. And it is part of our challenge as a state is that we're not creating enough housing to meet the needs of growing workforces in those areas. And if we don't do that, then we don't grow. And New Hampshire's always been, and Dennis is better at talking about this than I, but we've been an economy that relies on growth, both population growth and economic growth and job growth. And if you don't have an infrastructure, which includes housing, to support that growth, then you stagnate. And we went through a period of stagnation and we didn't like it. And now that we're starting to see a little bit of growth again, if we start reacting to that by putting up roadblocks to that growth, we're going to experience that stagnation again in a way that, again, we don't like.
Again, the number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. More conversation about affordable housing in the Granite State in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, how to break ground on affordable housing. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. The state's major employers have said this is a top concern for them. You can join us with your questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Our guests for the hour are Dean Christen, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority, and Dennis DeLay, Economist at the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies and co-author of a new report commissioned by the Housing Finance Authority. Gentlemen, here's an email that came in before the show. This is from Karen in Portsmouth. Now, Karen, it's a great email. It's long, so I'm not going to read the whole thing. She's worrying about the loss of diversity and mixed income neighborhoods having a detrimental impact on the city economy in the long run, such as not attracting young people, not attracting a workforce, not attracting a wide diversity of entrepreneurs and small business job creators, because you're not attracting a young people in the workforce. She says it's true that some sectors in Portsmouth are thriving, no problem attracting retirees and well-paid professionals, but others are hurting, judging by signs in the windows downtown and postings I'm seeing on social media. I would guess that easily one-third or more of the restaurants in Portsmouth are having a hard time hiring staff right now. Here's one more point that Karen makes. She says it's been great for the economies in Newmarket or Dover as more people opt to dig in and start up there where the rent is, at least this point, relatively more affordable. That's a piece of the puzzle that we should look at, Dean, that, you know, some places have become so expensive that it's meant benefit for other places that are less expensive.
Well, that's absolutely true. And you know, everything varies by market area. And Portsmouth is just an extremely attractive location for a lot of folks right now. And there's some gentrification there and some price appreciation. And some of those things you cannot necessarily regulate out of the way as a community. And so Portsmouth, I don't think, needs to be seen as a place where they've done something wrong necessarily. Could they do other things with inclusionary zoning policy or something of that nature? Maybe. And that's one of the things that other communities that have found themselves in this position have looked at. They've said, yes, we're going to allow development, but we're going to require a developer to make sure that a portion of that development serves a lower income population so that we can make sure that our service workers, our municipal workers, whomever it is we're concerned about, have a place to live. There are lots of models for that, both in other jurisdictions and indeed in New Hampshire, for how you can go about doing that. Now, in New Hampshire, inclusionary zoning has to be something that is an agreement between a developer and the community. You can't require it without giving the developer something in return, if you will.
So where does the money come from to do that?
Well, usually it's an internal subsidy, and it's basically the idea is you give a developer a density bonus, as we say in the business. We basically say you can build more units in that location than we would otherwise let you build, and in return for that, you've got to set some of those units aside to be affordable by some standard. Bedford has an inclusionary zoning ordinance, for instance. And Londonderry's workforce housing ordinance is sort of an inclusionary zoning ordinance. And so it's been done, and it can work if communities want to do that.
What do you think, Dennis?
Well, I think, again, as far as what Karen was talking about in terms of the restaurants having trouble hiring people, I think that's just a sign of the overall vibrancy, frankly, of the Portsmouth area, and probably speaks a little bit to the fact that housing is perhaps a little less affordable there. So those people that are, let's face it, that do work in restaurants are probably making a fairly low wage. They're more likely to be going to school themselves or trying to put themselves to school. So it's more difficult to attract people to take those jobs in Portsmouth if it's a significant commute away from where they already live. I think some of the things that Dean was just talking about in terms of towns being able to think about their housing policy creatively to provide density bonuses as they do in Bedford or some other towns are reasonable ways to free up or to increase the supply of housing. And again, you know, I just go back to what the data says. I mean, the data says is that we have a housing shortage right now, particularly on the rental side. And we have some – and frankly, some of that's being driven by lack of building. Some of it's just being driven by the way of federal regulations that have been put into place that make it harder for – young people, you know, that just want to start out and buy their own home and make it more difficult for them to get into the market. There's something called a qualifying mortgage, which essentially says that if you lend to somebody if you as a mortgage broker lend to them and that individual has a higher than 43% debt-to-income ratio and then that individual then defaults on that mortgage loan, they can come back to the mortgage broker and essentially sue them, for lack of a better term. Now, that really puts a chill on the ability, frankly, or the willingness of people that write mortgages to actually lend to people with very high debt-to-income ratios. But you think of the demographic group that fits – And you're really talking about college students, you know, people that have been recently graduated from college that are carrying very high levels of student debt that maybe have gotten together and decide they want to get into a house and find that the financial regulations are not going to let them get in.
So I think Dennis is right that it is a little harder for younger people to become first-time buyers than it used to be because of some of these regulatory requirements and also because of the level of student debt that they are carrying, which continues to increase.
That's why they have this interest in rental, because
exactly.
It's
tougher. But I think at the core of it, what remains is a shortage of housing, as he said early on, because their alternative is to rent somewhere, or to perhaps if we had more single-family housing being built at a lower cost, it would be easier for them to afford that housing.
Okay, here's an email from Ken that just came in. And Ken, glad you emailed. He says, the discussion I'm listening to at the moment seems to assume that new multifamily housing should not be for families with children. However, Ken says, low and moderate income families have children, just like middle class and rich families do. In fact, in light of the median income in the U.S., almost half the country's children come from low and moderate income families. Therefore, Ken says, in my opinion, our national housing strategy should be favoring multifamily housing for people who might not have a lot of money. We should not be trying to debate our housing strategy and exclude those families from it. Ken, that is absolutely not what we're trying to say here, that housing should not include low-income families. That's
not
what we're saying at all.
That was certainly not what I was saying. I was simply saying that the empirical evidence is that most of the people that live in rental housing do not have large families, do not have significant numbers of school-age children.
So you're countering that image that Gordon, our caller, gave.
I think there's a very good point there that you need to have a supply of rental housing that is available to that population. It's simply, to go to Dennis's point, the demographics are such that the number of families that are likely to be renters that have significant number of children is just going down, and there's just not as many school children in rental housing as people think.
Yeah, I wanted to set you straight on that, Ken, because that's absolutely not what we're saying. Go ahead, Dennis.
No, I was just the point is that whether we're talking about housing that's affordable for people of that are sort of workforce. That have workforce-level incomes or even people that have lower incomes than that, I think the data suggests that we have a shortage, on all sides of that. And even I think that there may be – because of some of the things that the caller from Londonderry was talking about in terms of requirements for one-acre zoning for single-family homes, that also affects – the affordability of single-family homes as well.
Here's another email. Thank you, by the way, Ken, for that one. Here's another email from Donna, who says, we don't need any more development. There are plenty of affordable existing houses already in the state. Donna, thanks for the email. Dean, what do you think?
Depends on where she lives. There are markets that still have very high inventories of affordable single-family homes. That's absolutely true. In the North Country, parts of the western part of the state, and even other sort of micro markets. But if you are in the Manchester or Nashua markets, if you're in the Seacoast, if you're in the Upper Valley, and increasingly parts of the Lake region, there basically is a shortage of housing across the board.
Here's two tweets that just came in. Andrew says, compared to Portsmouth, Concord is very affordable, could be a draw for millennials. Andrew, thank you for that tweet. Another tweet from Sandy, who says, how about housing incentives for millennials like we have for the 55-plus population? Stigma with the phrase affordable housing. So, Dennis DeLay, what do you think about Sandy's point, her tweet, how about housing incentives for millennials like we have for 55-plus?
Well, that's a really interesting way to put the problem. As part of the work that we've been talking about that we did for the Housing Finance Authority, we ran a series of focus groups. We talked to people that were advocates for workforce housing. We talked to people that were advocates for elderly housing. We talked to mortgage brokers and bankers, people that were builders. And one of the last groups that we talked to were a group of young professionals, millennials. And I'll never forget, as we ran this focus group, one of the people at the table, a young person that, again, had concerns about housing, looked at Russ Tebow and I, we did the study together, and said, well, you know, New Hampshire says they want us to stay here. Why do they make it so difficult for us to stay here? And I think that's what we're hearing in the tweet, that we seem to have programs that encourage older folks, people over the age of 55, to you know, either for builders to build that type of housing or for people to move into that type of housing. And the reason is obvious. People in their 50s to early 60s probably don't have children. So the local communities would love – seem to want to attract that type of housing. Again, we've heard, I think, as a running theme throughout everything we've talked about in the last hour, that there are a number of folks out there that still don't get the connection between economic development and affordable housing for all tiers of the income strata.
So I think that's one of the reasons why the legislature back in 08 decided to adopt the workforce housing legislation with very strong support from the business community and a lot of other folks. It was an attempt to offset what had been this trend for quite a while towards making the path of least resistance the 55 and older housing because of the lack of children, and it was easier for developers to go there. And there was a sense that we were getting an imbalance in the market and we weren't meeting needs. More recently, I think a very interesting little micro case. The legislature has been debating a bill that would allow the creation of accessory dwelling units in single-family homes. And what that is, that's a modern term for what we used to call in-law apartments.
Mother-in-law apartments.
Exactly,
yes.
Exactly. But the idea here is not necessarily for your in-laws, but in fact for someone
for
else to rent. And it has actually been moving its way through the process. It's in the House still. They're talking about it, but there's some prognosis that maybe that can move forward. And what that says is we need to recognize we have a lot of big houses that are perhaps larger than we really need, and we have this other need. And maybe we can make those work without having to change the fundamental character of our communities.
So these big old houses that people have back in the day when families had seven kids like
that's
the one
right.
Dennis grew
right.
up in, take those big old houses and turn them into something with a little rental unit here mm-hmm. or there. All right. Both of you, real interesting. Thank you so much for being
Thank
here.
You.
Really appreciate it. Dean, thanks. Good to see you.
Thank you very much.
That's Dean Kristen, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority. Dennis DeLay, always a pleasure. Thanks for your time.
Always a pleasure to be here, Laura. Thank you.
Dennis DeLay, economist at the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies, co-author of a new three-part report commissioned by the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Hallie Loft. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.